Hello, True Art Believers. This is Pearson here today. It's just another day in paradise. I just want to welcome everyone to this week's installment of the Artist Interview Series. Today we have professional photographer Rick Burke. Rick Burke, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm pretty good. How about you?
Doing pretty good. What'd you do today? What'd you have for breakfast?
Nothing, actually. I skipped breakfast this morning.
You just skipped right through it. Do you typically go out without breakfast, or do you have something?
No, I'll usually have yogurt or a protein bar or a bagel or something. But this morning I had to get up and get out and run a few errands, so I just like took off and didn't look back.
Was it photo related, or is it like personal, or is photo personal to you?
Well, I had to get my car serviced, so if I don't have a car, I can't go take photos. So both.
So. I was looking through your website and I was just seeing all these states. I was like, okay, what state has Rick not been to is what I was thinking. Cause I was just seeing all these states and I was like, wow, this dude has been everywhere. What places have you not been to but want to go to and take photos?
Hawaii and North Dakota and New Mexico were the top three that I haven't been to that I want to go to. Not in necessarily that order, but those three are like, you know, kind of itching at me that I haven't gotten to yet. Then Oklahoma, Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas. So I think I've been to 43 out of the 50.
So you're going to knock them all out soon? You hoping?
Hopefully.
Do you do a state a year, or do you do like a couple states each year, or is it like what determines where you go to photograph, Rick?
It really kind of depends on just kind of what I'm feeling like seeing and doing. I get wanderlust a lot. You know, oh, yeah. I like to go see new places and photograph them. You know, up until this summer, I had never seen the Rocky Mountains up close. So you know, as the coronavirus kind of hit and things kind of settled down about late June, a friend and I were talking about the fact I had already lost two workshops that I teach, and I had another trip canceled. I was supposed to go out to Washington and photograph in Olympics National Park, and that got canceled. So as things started relaxing a little bit, we were like, where can we go? You know, we just said, well, how about the Sawtooth Mountains? And so we decided we didn't want to fly. So I drove. I knocked out five states on that trip, just driving across the country to go photograph in Idaho at the Sawtooth Mountains. But really, it's how easy is it to get to, or how realistic is it to get to? And partly it's like, well, you know, do I want to photograph something vastly different, or what?
Do you do a lot more traveling in your vehicle, in your car, or do you fly more often?
Used to be more flying. This year it's been more driving. Last year I flew to Washington State and photographed in the Palouse. This year starting last fall, everything was road trips. Last fall I did a bunch of mini road trips. I went to Vermont for a week and photographed the fall foliage. Then I went to Pennsylvania and upstate New York and finished that road trip in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And then came back home to Maine. And then, you know, like I said, Idaho. And then last month I went to Colorado and drove that one also. Partly because of the pandemic at this point, it just seems safer to drive than anything else. I can limit my contact with others and, you know, kind of be sensible about it without, and still get my goal, which was to go photograph in these places.
Do you take impromptu stops along the way to those locations to photograph as well? Or are you just, you're just going straight?
Oh no, we'll, me and this friend that I travel with, her name's Kristen Wilkinson, we'll research our route and figure out if there's what's along the way to stop and shoot. We'll build in time, you know, on the way so that the journey is as much fun as the destination, you know? For instance, in Idaho, we stopped in Cleveland, Ohio, spent an evening photographing the Cleveland skyline. The next day we stopped in Iowa City, Iowa. So when we left the following morning, we got up early and shot early morning in Madison County with the bridges of Madison County. And then from there, we drove through Illinois and I don't know. My order of states is wrong, but drove through Nebraska and we stopped at a couple of landmarks in Nebraska along the way before we finished up the day in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So we'll research the route and see what's there and decide if we can spare a couple hours or a day for it. Did similar on the way to Colorado last month as well. It's easier in the summer to do that when you have longer days. When the days are shorter and you have to get somewhere, becomes a little more difficult.
Yeah. So those are like cool events, like road trips. Like it seems like you've done a lot of road trips. Yes. This year.
Yeah. In the last year, I think four or five.
And how long do those usually span? You know, like months,
Anywhere from 3 or 4 days to the Colorado and Idaho trips were both 2 weeks.
Okay. So when you're not doing road trips and you're at home, at your home base, where's your time going? Like, what are you doing there when you're as a photographer?
When I'm home editing stuff from when I'm on the road, it takes a lot of my time. Doing the marketing end of things that is necessary to get people to see my work and hopefully purchase. And then I will photograph a lot locally. New England is beautiful, so there's no shortage of places for me to go, either locally in Maine, or I can head down to Massachusetts or New Hampshire, or Vermont is only a couple hours away too, so I can, you know, take a day trip and just go.
So you went to two trips to the Rockies recently. Yeah?
Yeah.
And tell us more about that.
I had never seen the Rockies up close other than to fly over them on my way to California or Oregon in the past. So it was always something that was kind of on my bucket list to shoot, and I'd never really had the opportunity to do that. And this year, well, last year I had planned with Kristen, I planned the Colorado trip. We had booked that at last September. A full year in advance. And then this year, the Idaho trip, we'd been talking about the Sawtooths, didn't know when we were going to get there, but then when things kind of relaxed and stuff happened, we just planned on going and went. But, you know, it was just, there's something about the mountains. I mean, that saying, the mountains are calling and I must go, you know, rings very true for me. It's just, you know, they bring me a lot of peace. So going out there and just pulling out my camera and starting to photograph what's there just really gets to me.
Just why the mountains specifically?
I don't know exactly. I guess makes me feel small, you know, makes my problems feel small. I just find it very relaxing, very calming. You know, and it's just, they're just so beautiful. You know, it's nice to see nature untouched in many ways.
Yeah, like when I would go to Arizona to visit family, like they had those mountains around the area, and I they just have really cool skylines. You know, they map the skyline better than, you know, obviously when you have a flat surface and you just have flat surface and then you have sky, it's not as interesting. But when you have these really cool peaks and then they affect how the surrounding area looks, it does have a serene feel to it.
Yeah. I lived on Long Island, New York for 21 years, and it's about the flattest piece of land I've ever seen. Not that there's not interesting parts to it, but it's overall, there's just not a whole lot to it, you know, in terms of geological features. You know, has beautiful beaches and such, but yeah, that's kind of where it stops. If you want waterfalls, if you want mountains, you head upstate New York or up into New England or whatever. Living in Maine, I get the best of both worlds. I get, you know, this gorgeous dramatic coastline, and 2 hours north, I get, you know, these, well, compared to the Rockies, they're smaller, but they're still beautiful mountains.
Maine, do you enjoy fresh seafood?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Like
I have my favorite lobster shack on the dock, and every year I try to go there a few times and get a good lobster roll.
what would that cost?
A lobster roll will cost you about $20, $25, depending on where you get going for it. It's more expensive than a burger, but a lot better tasting in many ways.
Yeah. So that must be nice to have that kind of access to like free, like not free seafood, but like ch cheaper seafood. Like whenever you when you ever go, do you ever when you're going on your travels and you go to like some random restaurant that is on the way that's not even near the sea, and you ever try this stuff that try their cuisine, you're like, this is it's not good,
I have a rule. I don't eat seafood in a landlocked state.
right? Fair enough, fair enough. I have some family in Maine, and I from my understanding like the tide rises really quick and raise like goes up and down really quick like in the evening or something. Is that
In
true?
some parts, it depends on the parts. If you go further east, or they call it down east, out towards the eastern tip and like Lubeck, the tides are more dramatic there and they change very quickly. I'm in an area, I'm just like a half hour north of Portland, which is more the middle of the state if you were going up the coastline. And they're not quite as dramatic. They are more dramatic than, say, the Jersey Shore or New York, New York coastline or whatever. But it's not as extreme, let's say, as further out.
Rick, can you tell me about your relationship to art as a kid? What was it like?
Yeah, growing up, I always had a sketchbook in my hands. I used to draw constantly. Different things. I would draw my sports heroes growing up. I was a big Yankee fan. My dad was a big Mets fan, so I would draw Mets players and Giants and Jets players, stuff like that. I would draw some fantasy stuff. I always it always kind of frustrated me a little bit because I was okay at it, but I could never quite get it where I wanted it to be. When I got to college, I was an art major, specifically graphic design. And the more I got immersed in it in my college courses, the less it felt like the right thing for me to be doing. And then I had to take a photo course as a requirement. And the first time I developed my first roll of film in a dark room was it. I was hooked.
Why
So.
did you feel less like graphic design was the thing?
I'm not sure exactly. It just I didn't feel the passion for it. I didn't feel the motivation, to do it. There were other people that I saw who were I felt much better than I was at it. So it kind of felt like, maybe I was barking up the wrong tree or something with it. I don't know. Part of it was that like the school I went to, the art majors were all, let's say, unique. They had purple hair, or they had, weird piercings, or they were all goth, stuff like that. And I didn't fit that mold. I still looked very kind of preppy or almost jockish in a way. So I was kind of like, well, I don't fit with them. And it was just a strange thing for me to kind of realize that maybe that wasn't for me. But it once I like I said, once I hit on photography, those were more people kind of like me in a way. So I kind of, gravitated towards that instead.
Yeah, since it's like Halloween, you didn't fit the art costume mold.
Exactly.
I feel the same way. Like the dyed hair, and then like the capri pants, and wearing no shoes, walking around, and the extreme V-necks, right? Like Phoenix's went down for days, and then like the lots of booze and smoking. And I was like, I don't smoke, so
Yeah.
or like the lack of sleep grunge look. And maybe the photographer is cut from a different like type of cloth. I don't think I really know any photographers that look like the standard, artist cut, the appearance that we get that perception of.
Right.
Is that kind of true? Is it?
I've met a few in my travels. I've been around the photo industry for, like 25 years now. And in that time I worked for Canon as a field rep for a while as a technical rep. I used to teach, classes for Canon at different camera stores, and then I work photo retail. So you meet all kinds, and I've met a few who lean towards that artsy mold that we talked about, but then just as many who are more like me and kind of more reserved and go about things their own way.
So what was that? What caused that light bulb in your head, that like flick of a switch when you made your first when you what's it called when you make the you said it was the
Did you develop your first roll of film?
develop the film. Yes, sorry,
If anybody remembers what that is at this point.
yeah, like what's developing film? What's film, right?
Well, at that point, like I said, I used to draw my sports heroes growing up in my sketchbook. And then when I developed my first roll of film, the first place I went to take pictures, and I don't know why I went there at this point, but the first place I went was my old high school football field where I played high school football. It was empty. There was no game going on or anything, but it kind of dawned on me that, hey, I could be a sports photographer. So that was like my first, kind of role in photography. I focused on, no pun intended, becoming a sports photographer. I started shooting my old high school's games and submitting pictures to the local paper, and they were publishing them. And then, over time, that grew from doing local high schools to local colleges, and then I got a shot to photograph pro sports for a baseball card company. So I would do Yankees and Mets games. I would do NFL games. I would travel the country doing the NFL. Did a lot of hockey games, NHL hockey games. So I got that opportunity, and that was, my first life as a professional photographer. Over time, I started doing more landscape stuff, like what you see on my website now. At that point, it was just kind of therapeutic and relaxing to me. And then it just gradually shifted where I got out of sports photography. I mean, part of the reason was the industry was just really eating itself up. There's not a lot of money to be made there anymore. And I had a family to support and wanted to do something else. So that was kind of when I started working for Canon, and I still kept doing landscape photography as a relaxation thing. And that's going on 15 years ago at this point. So it's kind of grown from there to where I am now.
Did you get free baseball cards when you
Yeah,
worked for that
I got
company?
some. I got a bunch. Yeah.
Did you ever get did they did you ever get like the would you ever get like the pre-cut before they actually cut them in the cards?
No, they never gave me any sheets.
Oh yeah.
No.
Oh, darn. Darn.
I used to get like they would give me like a box of unopened packs, and I would have to go through the packs and sift through to find the ones that I shot.
Oh yeah.
And I'd go through and be like, "Oh, yep, shot that one, shot that one, shot that one. That's not mine. That's not mine. That one's mine." And
What?
I still have a book or two of them around here somewhere.
Are any of the, do you think any of them are worth something now?
No.
No? No?
No,
Baseball?
That's part of the reason why the photography end of things went down in sports is the card company started producing so many cards that it just overloaded the market. Part of the reason why the older cards are rare is because nobody ever thought they were going to be worth anything until 30 years afterwards. So
yeah. And is that when you were doing photography for like events, sporting events, like games, or is that one and the same with the baseball cards?
Yeah, it was pretty much the same.
And is that why it was started cannibalizing? Was there like, how was the opportunity shrinking? Was there more and more photographers going into that field, and then like everyone started bidding himself down or something? Or
that was part of it. That was a big part of it. You know, that was right after autofocus started coming into its own, probably about 10 years after the introduction of the first autofocus cameras. So now everyone thought they could do it.
Yeah.
And people were saying, I'll shoot it for free if you just get me on the sidelines kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
The other part of it was some of the baseball card companies were going out of business.
Yeah.
So there were fewer slots and more photographers for those slots. So the card companies were like, well, it's a buyer's market. We can pay what we want for it. And
yeah.
Whereas I was making, I think, like $400 a game back then. Prior to my getting into the industry, you used to get paid by the amount of the number of by the photos on the cards, like $50 to $75 per card. So, like my best year, they used 3,000 of my images. If I had gotten paid $50 per image used, I would have had $150,000 gross that year. Instead, I made $65,000 because I got paid $400 a game. Now those same companies are paying $250 a game.
So. All right. And then you transitioned to Canon. And then you did those workshops, and now you're doing traveling around the world and doing more personal work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it sounds very, very hectic when you are structuring your road trips. Do you have any like habits that you've acquired or learned that have made you more efficient or more time efficient or better at scheduling things? Or was it this something that kind of was natural for you?
Mostly it's just stuff. It's just come naturally. I wouldn't say there's any habits, at least not on the surface or any that were consciously developed, but, you know, it's just part of it is, you know, there is some hecticness to it, but I'm not one for just taking it easy. Usually, if I'm not going, I feel like I'm being too lazy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I go out on these trips, it's like, okay, I've got this time to go out and shoot. Mm-hmm. That it's just a matter of where am I going here, and then where can I go from that point to the next point to get what I want, and then okay, this is midday, the light's going to be bad that time of day, I'll go get a meal, and then I'll pick my spot for sunset and go back out again. I've had people with me at times where, you know, they're like, you got to slow down, dude, I can't keep up. Thankfully, you know, right now, my travel photography partner has the same kind of, I don't want to call it drive, but stamina, I guess, where we just keep going until there's no light anymore. And then, you know, it's like, okay, that's the day. And where are we going tomorrow? And what time are we getting up for it? So,
is it sun up to sun down for you?
Yes, and then some. Sometimes if there's a night sky opportunity to shoot the Milky Way or star trails or something, it'll be sun up till it gets dark. And then usually if I do night sky stuff, it means that sunrise the next morning isn't going to happen for me because, you know, everybody has their limits. But, for the most part, they're 16, 18 hour days a lot of times.
Yeah. And how many photos do you think you take in one of those days?
Usually it's a couple hundred.
Couple hundred? Yeah,
300-400. It depends on how many stops we get, how much change there is, and how much variety of subject matter there is at a given location. For instance, if there's like some spots, there's one shot to get or one composition to get, or maybe one or two variations on the same composition, while other spots there's lots of room to move around and get different angles and find different compositions. And then there's different light. You get one that's kind of like late afternoon sun, and then you'll wait for that sunset light, and then you'll wait for blue hour light. So you've got a bunch of different lighting, and you can try a different composition with each of those too. Out of the 2 weeks I was gone for the Colorado trip, I came back with over 50 finished images.
And that's out
So
of
that was
400 p pictures a day.
give or take. It depends. Some days were only like 150 or 200. Like I said, it depends. It can be a pretty wide range of how many I'll take. I'll take more if I'm shooting moving water. For instance, if I'm on the coast of Maine and there's waves crashing over rocks, then I'll take more because I'll be trying to time the waves just perfectly for that perfect splash over the rocks or whatever. And that can be like 300 shots in an hour. So.
Because I imagine you don't want like it just midway. You want that sprinkling, maybe.
Yeah, you want that kind of peak splash where it's kind of exploding over the rocks a little bit.
And how do you store? Do you keep all those files, or do you just delete? You don't delete them.
No, I don't delete anything.
So how do you store all that stuff? Like I'm curious about that because I'm like running out of like memory in my on my computer, and I'm figuring out like how do I store all this stuff? So what do you do? What kind of devices do you use for that type of thing?
Right now, I'm still very kind of low tech. I haven't invested in like a RAID array or anything like that. I use external hard drives. Right now, I have two 10 terabyte drives that hold everything that I've shot in the last probably 15 years. And since the drives are getting bigger, the next ones will probably be 16 terabytes each or 20 terabytes each, whatever. But they're the like those Western Digital drives that they make. And then I back everything up in the cloud using a backup service so that constantly monitors those drives. So every time I add new files to it, the backup service kicks in and automatically starts uploading the raw files to the cloud. So if heaven forbid, one of the drives fails, or even worse, like the house burned down or something, then then at least I know my files are safe and I can get back on my feet with them.
What cloud service do you recommend? Because I want to get on that. Like, what cloud service do you work with?
I've been real happy with Backblaze. I've been using them for about 5 years now. I think it's about $100 for 2 years of service. It lets you monitor whatever drives you want to. So, I can have a couple of different drives, and the drives that kind of have my master files on them are what I have it monitor, and I don't worry about, some of the other stuff that I have that are just like, random storage drives. But it seems to do a really good job backing things up. Thankfully, I haven't had to find out how good their restoration service is. But it makes me feel better knowing that I have that, as opposed to having no backups, or just a physical backup here on the on my computer in my house. 'Cause,
Backblaze. 20 terabytes, you say, total?
Well, one drive is less than half full right now. That's the current drive. I have 10 terabytes for everything going back from about 2005 forward. And then the second drive that is still being added to has about 4 terabytes right now, and that picks up last September to current. So I'm getting a little more prolific as I go.
So how do you like, do you have a filing system for that? Or like, how's that? What do you, is that what you, so you're saying that you spend a lot of time editing in your editing process. Is that include filing, like labeling it, everything accordingly?
Yeah, it's pretty. When I come back from, and a lot of this will happen on my laptop as I'm traveling. I have, a small portable drive that I'll take with me when I'm on the road. And at the end of a day, I'll come back and I'll download whatever what I shot for that day. Everything gets put into folders in the same kind of fashion. The folders are labeled by year, month, and day, and then the location I was at. That way, when I sort them by file name on my computer, everything is listed in date order or reverse date order, depending on how I sort them. Mm-hmm. And I can look at that folder and know exactly what's in it just based on the location. Then within there, there's a folder for images I've processed, and then those are saved as TIFFs or PSDs, depending on what mood I'm in. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be saved as a JPEG for uploading to my website so they can be printed by my lab when people order them.
What's the difference between a PSD and a TIFF?
Well, PSD is the native Photoshop file.
Yeah, like what's quality-wise?
Quality-wise, I don't know that there is much difference. I've never really looked into it. I know TIFFs are a little more universal, so I mostly save stuff as TIFFs. The only stuff that gets saved as PSDs is if I'm doing a composite that's taking, you know, a bunch of layers to make work, because then I'll save that composite in layer form so that if heaven forbid I need to go back and fix something or change something, I still have the entire assembly in its separate pieces rather than, you know, all merged into one.
Okay, so you've kind of brushed upon this a little bit. Now, this is one of my questions. What is like your process with photography? How do you work as a photographer? Because you kind of talked about how you have layers and then your 18-hour days. What is your standard, like, step one, do this, step two, and all the way to, if maybe there's 50 steps, I don't know, of how you come to your final product? Like a general one, not like a very specific one, like just like a general, like average.
First step would be research. I'll research the location that I'm planning to shoot. A lot of times that research just means I'm doing a Google search to see, you know, what the place is like, if it's someplace I've never been, you know, just to get a feel for what I'm going to find when I get there. Because a lot of times when I go to a place, the first time I see it is actually in the dark, because if I get up for sunrise, that means getting up, you know, getting to the spot at least an hour before the sun's ever up. So I want to at least get a kind of feel for what I'm getting into before I get there. Because, you know, you show up in the dark, you really don't have any idea what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
From there, it's like, okay, where do I need to go? So I'll get directions or get an idea of where I need to go, put it into my GPS. And then, you know, by that point, I've usually, having seen the location, I probably come across other people's photos of it, whether they be, you know, travel snaps or another photographer like myself who did something really nice. And I'll get into my head the kind of image I want to come away with. I'll look at the weather report to see what the weather's supposed to be like, just so I'm prepared, you know, both for clothing and also for the kind of light I might get, which will then alter what kind of image I'm hoping to get out of the place. Then I just go and I wait for the light to come up. I've got my camera set up on the tripod and I start taking pictures. I'll try a bunch of different compositions, you know, and usually I can tell if I have it, you know, just looking at the back of the camera. It's never going to look finished on the back of the camera, but yeah, I'll know that I have what I need to work with when I get it into my editing process, that I can come away with, you know, what I want. Then I come home and I edit on a Mac Mini here in my house. And, you know, that's usually where, you know, I finalize the image and then I upload it and, you know, start sharing it out on social media.
Mm-hmm. And do you when you go inside, does that include like hiking of sorts, or is like a yeah, what's that like?
Depends on where it is. I've had you know, times where I've hiked, you know, 3 or 4 miles, and times where, you know, maybe it's only been a half a mile. In Idaho, in the Sawtooth Mountains this summer, there was this trail above Redfish Lake called the Bench Lakes Trail.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a, I think a 7 mile out and back hike. So you walk out, there's Redfish Lake, and then there's four lakes above Redfish Lake up in the mountains. So you're at about 9,000 feet elevation. So that one, we hiked up to the first two lakes. The trail ends at the second lake, but there's two more beyond that you can bushwhack to. So my friend Kristen and I got to the second lake and we took some pictures, and then I looked at her and I said, do you want to go for the third lake? And she said, well, we're here. So I said, okay. And we went to the third lake. It ended up being a 12-mile round trip hike. Took the better part of about 6 hours, I think, for us to do it, between stopping to photograph and just, you know, being tired. You know, I like to hike, but I wouldn't call myself an avid hiker necessarily. Yeah. But, you know, if that's what I got to do to go get a shot, then that's what I got to do.
Do you, have you ever been in a situation, or have you ever planned like camping on site?
I've thought about it and talked about it. I've never done it.
Oh man.
It will come eventually, I'm sure, because I have an idea for a shot that I've wanted to do. There's a mountain here in Maine called Tumbledown Mountain.
Uh-huh.
It's not a long hike. It's maybe 3 miles up the mountain. And when you get to just below the summit, there's an alpine lake there, and it's just pristine. It's so beautiful. I would like to get to the summit and shoot sunrise from the summit. So either that means I do it at, you know, 2 a.m. in pitch dark, or I hike up for sunset and then I camp out there and, you know, get up in time to shoot the sunrise over the ridge. So
that should be fun.
Yeah, it should be. I just have to figure out how to do it, and I have to get somebody to come do it with me, because I'm not going to camp up there alone. I'm not that brave.
Do you have any, like, is it something in, like, the next foreseeable future, or is it going to be, like, years from now?
I would have told you it was supposed to happen this year, and then, you know, things got away from me, and I did other stuff. It's something I would probably like to do by, you know, early next summer if I can get away with it.
And when we're going to backpedal a little bit, talk about your process a little bit more. You mentioned like layering, and you do Photoshop manipulation. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, mostly it's color and contrast adjustments to bring out the most out of the photo. I find, you know, digital cameras throw away a lot of detail if you let them. So I shoot a raw file, which gives me all the information the camera can capture, and then I'll bring it out in Photoshop to get the most out of it that I want. Once in a while, you know, depending on where I was and what I was doing, once in a while, you know, I'll do a sky swap or something like that just to add some drama to a scene that maybe wasn't there. More often than not, that's like when it's a once in a lifetime trip and I can't get back for the right light. But it's not too often.
What's a sky swap? Is that when you like literally,
let's say you have a bland sky, like no clouds, or, you know, kind of gray overcast and just flat looking. And you want to make it a little more interesting.
Put like Godzilla in the background or something.
Well, you could, if you wanted to. I try to keep it. I mean, it's one of those things. More often than not, I try to just capture what I see and bring out the most out of it. But once in a while, you know, you have a shot that overall the composition is good, the subject matter is all there. Technically, the shot is well exposed and well focused and everything. But, you know, it's just missing something. And, you know, like I said, if it's a place I can't get back to easily, you know, like anywhere in Maine, I can pretty much watch the weather and be like, hey, tomorrow looks like a good day, I'm taking off. But, you know, like for instance, if it's Colorado or something, you know, and I get, you know, just a flat blue sky and, you know, I've got these mountains that look great, but they could use a little help, you know, then, you know, maybe I drop a sky in just to add a little punch to it. It's cool. Art, so it's not like I'm, you know, a photojournalist who's manipulating the news. For me, it's just another part of the artistic process.
The sky was red, trust me. No. it was raining. It was raining blood. No, that's crazy. So what are some of the the coolest photo excursions that you've done?
God, they're all different. They're probably my favorite though was Alaska. I went to Alaska 10 years ago. It was my second trip there. My brother was stationed at Fort Richardson up outside Anchorage.
Yeah.
And so I went up to visit him, and we camped in Denali National Park at Wonder Lake for, I think, 4 or 5 days. And, you know, taking the park loop, the park bus into the campsite, there was just these dramatic clouds swirling around Denali. It was just amazing. And then we took a flight scene tour the next morning out of the airfield that's inside the park, just north of Wonder, I think it's north or south of Wonder Lake, and in a Cessna. And, you know, I did a lot of aerial photography from the plane and just got some incredible shots of these mountains. And the coolest thing was that the plane we were in had a ceiling of about 11,000 feet, and Denali is 20,000 feet. So you're sitting in this plane and you're still going like this to see the top of it, and you're 11,000 feet off the ground. And it's like, you know, like I said about feeling small earlier, that's one way to do it.
That's very cool. So Alaska 10 years ago, huh?
Yeah.
Rick, clearly you have a lot of business smarts in the art field, right? I think so. We've established that. Do you have any business advice for artists? They could be up and coming, kind of already established, or there can be this, you know, maybe they want to like, I want to sell art or whatever. Do you have any like advice that would help them as a heading?
Well, I think, you know, it's easy to get sucked into the life that we're kind of expected to live at times. You know, art, for whatever reason, art is kind of frowned upon in this country. I mean, we love to consume art, but actually being an artist, you know, it's weird. It's both frowned upon and admired. You know, you tell someone, oh, I'm going to be an artist. And like when I was a teenager and said I wanted to be a photographer, you know, at 18, 19 years old, you know, I had people tell me, well, you should take some business courses just in case, stuff like that. And it's easy to get sucked into that. Well, I have to get a regular job and I have to, you know, have the 2.5 kids in the house and all that stuff. And
I haven't
realized until like, you know, the last couple of years that, you know, for a while that kind of thing, you know, I was miserable. I mean, I love my kids. I wouldn't trade them for the world, but, trying to work in corporate and, you know, fit that mold that wasn't me, it made me miserable. And, you know, here I am, you know, 20 years later after that. And, now I'm getting back to what I wanted to do, you know, way back when I was holding a sketchbook in my hand and said I was going to be an artist when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my wife will tell you I'm much happier. And, you know, it's been a long game trying to make it work, but it's starting to come together and it's starting to work a lot more for me than, you know, I ever dreamed it would be possible to do. So I guess just, you know, if you have that dream, you know, stick to it, you know, figure out what you have to do to make it happen. But, you know, if art is different than most other jobs because it's a calling, it's a passion,
yeah.
As opposed to saying, well, I think I'd like to be an accountant or, you know, a salesman or whatever. I don't know. I know people who like their jobs who do that stuff,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they go home and constantly think about, you know, photography, whereas me and I can get together with two or three other photographers and we'll talk photography for hours. And it's not like we're talking shop. We're just talking life.
So, any like interesting, like sales tactic that you've learned, like sales tactics that you've learned or like, business tactics, right?
I wish I could say that there was. It's not really.
Darn.
It's the main thing is you have to you have to kind of get over. I mean, there's always that, as artists, we all have that fear. Well, what if they don't like it? Or what if, you know, what if I stink? Or you kind of have to get past that and just put yourself out there. I found that, you know, good things happen when I put myself out there. You know, you don't necessarily have to be the used car salesman kind of guy. You know, you don't have to be, you know, slick about it. You just kind of, with artists, you know, we're not supposed to be like that. I think it's more, I mean, certainly guys like Peter Lick, you know, they have that sales thing down to a science and they make it work for them. But I think, if we, you know, if you're just honest and you know, kind of let people get a glimpse of, you know, who you are as an artist and show them your stuff and put yourself out there, it resonates with art collectors and buyers. So.
Cool. I have a question that you may not want to answer, but you can. What is the, in your opinion, the most overrated type of photography?
This is going to sound politically correct. I don't know that any of them are overrated. I think most types of photography are vastly underrated.
Okay.
Because the way the camera companies have advanced the technology to the point where you put any camera on auto and you're going to come up with a good shot makes most people think that they can be a professional photographer.
I've heard that before. Tell me more about that.
I mean, all of the technology that's in these image processors and in the cameras, you know, it makes it very easy. You throw the camera on auto and the camera knows what it's looking at. It knows if it's seeing a face, it knows if it's looking at a landscape. It knows if it's seeing, you know, neon lights or whatever. And it'll figure that stuff out. And Joe Average, unless they're really bad at working with technology, can come away with a relatively halfway decent image. But I think if you look at enough photography, you know, you can kind of see, like if you're in some of these groups on social media or you browse through Instagram, you can kind of see who really kind of has extended it, to another level and who is working, you know, with the basics. And there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, but there is definitely more to it than just pushing the button. You know, I've taught enough people who have said, you know, we've been at the same location and they'll say, well, why doesn't my photo look like your photo? And it comes down to, you know, what I'm doing in the exposure, you know, my selections for depth of field and shutter speed. And then how I'm manipulating the light. Am I using filters on my lenses to hold back light in certain spots or to get a slower exposure than they would get without using those filters, especially if they're not aware of how to use them or that they even exist. Mm-hmm. And then with what you do in post-processing. I tell people when I teach them post-processing and working in Photoshop that with the way cameras are now, you know, you give 10 people the same camera and they point them all at the same scene, chances are very good that they're all going to come away with an image that looks similar. Editing your images to your taste is your final chance to put your own stamp on the image. You mm-hmm. give 10 people that same image and give them Photoshop. If they have a working knowledge of Photoshop, whether it be very basic or more advanced, you'll get 10 different versions of that look very different. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, it's that whole process. And, you know, you'll see people who haven't mastered the capture end of things, but they're working on it. And you'll see people who haven't mastered the processing end of things. Mm-hmm. Some people stop at capture and don't get into processing. Other people take it the whole way. And we're all at different stages of that. But I think, you know, the general public looks at that. To get back to your question about overrated or underrated, I think the general public looks at, you know, the fact that you can throw the camera on auto and get a decent picture, or worse, throw your phone, you know, put your camera app on your phone out there and get a halfway decent picture. And they think it's just as simple as pushing a button. So then we're undervalued.
Okay. And so what, What is some like underrated photography that you want to give a shout out to, like that no one really knows about?
I've seen a, I mean, I've worked with so many different photographers over the years. I don't know that it's all seems to be underrated in some respect in terms of, the, you like I said, going back to, you can put a camera on auto and get decent pictures, but, there's some phenomenal portrait photographers out there who take portrait photography to another level. I mean, most of our experience with portrait photography kind of stops at
JCPenney.
JCPenney. My mom used to drive me to JCPenney when I was a kid, and put us in. It was the 70s, so I have these weird suits on. Never forgive her for those, but then you see, if you go book a private photo shoot with a photographer, a real professional photographer, and not someone working in one of those formulaic studios, you'll see kind of the art involved. If you get a real creative type who really knows their craft, you get some phenomenal images that you would never get out of a shoot at JCPenney or whatever the place in the mall is at this point, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Are there really malls now? Are they gone? Are they still here?
I was in one today, actually.
They exist. I was like, what's pretty soon the couple generations from now they'll be like, what's a mall?
Right.
Right? Like, oh, back in my day I used to hang out at the mall. Like they're like, whatever, grandpa. Rick, what is your what would be a dream project for you? Or one that you maybe you might have be have like what one that you might have in planning right now, or one that you've been thinking about but you don't have any plans in the foreseeable future?
I mean, I'm kind of working on it anyway. It's just kind of to document, a lot of the national parks in this country. I mean, I've done a bunch. I live within, 2 hours, 2.5 hours of Acadia National Park here in Maine, so I get to spend a lot of time there. I've been to Yosemite a bunch of times, Denali twice. This summer, I hit Badlands for a day and Grand Tetons for a day and a half. Neither one was long enough, but it's what I could, afford to put in there on those road trips. I hit Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado last month, so I'm slowly working my way through them all, but I want to get through as many of them as I possibly can. Just because the landscape in each of them is so unique and different from the others that it's just amazing to see how nature kind of, finds a way in each of the different regions of the country.
So Rick, what's next? Like what's next in your on your photography plate?
Well, this weekend I'm going out to this island off the coast of Maine called Vinyl Haven. It's a real quick trip. Part of it is a getaway with my wife. We just celebrated our 3 year anniversary of meeting each other.
Oh, congratulations.
So it's a getaway for that. And then the other part of it is that I have a, I guess a customer, a client who she's purchased a bunch of my work and has expressed interest in seeing images of that island. So it's like, well, it's only a little ways away. It's an hour and a half ferry ride off the coast. So you know what? Let me take a couple of days and go out there and explore it with my camera a little bit and see what I can get out of it. Whether or not it sells doesn't really matter to me. If I can get some good images, I'll be happy, and then we'll see what happens with it. But it's kind of one of those nice trips that I can blend business and pleasure together and just kind of have fun. I mean, really, it's all pleasure anyway, so.
Yeah, I guess that's what it sounds like. Rick, care to share any life advice?
I'm not sure anybody should be taking life advice from me. I would say, again, if you have dreams, just, you know, don't be deterred and don't get distracted from them, because life's too short. It's too easy to get sucked into the expectations of society at large. You know, do what makes you happy. It's just, you know, I've been there where, you know, I spent so much time trying to do what I thought I was supposed to do, and I was miserable at it, suffered from depression because of it. And it's only the last few years where I figured out that, you know what, just make this work for you and you'll be happy. And so far, so good.
That's good. That's good for you, man. Happy for you. I'm out of questions. I actually have one question that I wanted to put in there. What are the top three restaurants that you've been to on your travels?
Oh, okay. This is going to be tough because that means I have to remember their names. There was one I know in Anchorage, Alaska, a place called Glacier Brewhouse.
Glacier Brewhouse, huh?
Yeah. They brew their own beer, and they have the best Alaskan King crab legs I've ever had.
Oh, wow. How were they large? Like, how big are those crab legs?
Like a circumference of 2 or 3 inches and then probably about 18 inches long.
Oh, wow. Like that.
They're huge. They cut them in half down the lengthwise, and you just scoop the meat out with a fork and dip it in drawn butter. And, you know, I think they served it with coleslaw and like fries or something.
What other two places have you been to that were really interesting or really good?
Let's see. This year was tough because of, you know, COVID. I didn't eat out as much as I would have. You know, we did a lot of our own cooking to try and minimize our exposure. Here in Maine, there's a place called Five Islands Lobster. It's in about a half an hour from where I live. It's one of the cutest fishing harbors you'll ever see. But you can literally sit on the dock and you'll see a lobsterman pull up to the dock and, you know, unload his catch right there. And it pretty much walks right into the kitchen, and, you know, it's the next lobster roll that you order or whatever. So, the lobster rolls are fantastic there, and they have, you know, some great, you know, clams and shrimp and other stuff too. So, that's one. And, so many. Oh, I know. Outside Dallas, there's a barbecue place called the Heart 8 Barbecue. That one sticks with me because you walk in, the pit is outside the restaurant, you know, under an awning, and there's all this meat out on the grill, and you just kind of point to it and tell them you want some of that and some of that and some of that. And they put it on a tray and they weigh it, and you pay based on the weight. Wow. And then you take the tray inside and you can pick up your sides, your mac and cheese, your cornbread and whatever else, and then get your drinks and then you go sit down, and oh my God, some of the best barbecue I've ever had.
Do you actually research where to find these places on the when you're planning, or you just kind of stumble upon them?
Glacier Brewhouse, because my brother lived outside Anchorage, he knew about it, so he took us there. Heart 8 Barbecue, I found that when I was working for Canon. We had a company meeting down there, and one of the local sales reps had told us to go there. A lot of times it's some research online. Other times it's knowing some locals or people who have been there before who can tell you. There's a great, I can't remember the place, in Phoenix, Arizona, there's a phenomenal Mexican place that I ate at too. That was really good. And, you know, the name escapes me right now. It's about 7 years ago that I was there. So,
well, Rick, I just want to say, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day. I know when we first started, I was getting like a little bit, I was sweating a little bit. It's like, oh my gosh, because we were having like audio issues, real bad ones too. Like, because you were cracking so bad, and then I was hearing everything I was saying like a second and a half later. So everything I would say, I just hear it in my ear. I'm like, oh, I'm hearing all these noises in my head, and then I tried. We were manipulating with the sound and speakers. This wasn't working. Deep down inside, I was like, oh gosh, please don't do this. We were mentioning this, where I mentioned this. I was like, the more I've been doing this, the more like technical issues I've been having. Like when I first started, I had no problems, but now I'm like, I was having all these problems, and I was, and it's been kind of weird how that's occurring. Rick, I just want to say thank you so much for taking time of your day and talking to me about your profession and talking to me about your art and craft. You know, I really do appreciate it. Before we go, where can people find you?
Okay. Well, my website is rickburke.com, real easy. Mm-hmm. And then on Instagram, it's Rick Burke Photo. Facebook, it's facebook.com/rickburkephoto. That's the two places I'm most active on social media. There's a Twitter out there, but I don't do much with it. But those two places, and my website, of course, is where I, you know, add all my work first before anywhere else. So,
Rick, before we break for the day, we actually have a question here. If you looked at the side, it said, "What camera did you use for your Mount Sneffels shot? The clarity on your photograph is stunning."
Mount Sneffels. Well, I'm using it. Back in May, I switched to Sony A7R4. Camera. I had been shooting Nikon D850 before that, and before that was a Nikon D810, and then before that I was shooting Canon 5D Mark IIIs. So
that's all foreign language to me. What makes the camera that you use for the Mount Sneffels one so special? Unique? How is it an upgrade from your previous ones?
Well, I think the main thing is that the Sony is much newer to the game than Canon or Nikon, so they're using all their lenses are much newer technology. They, you know, first one of the reasons that made me switch was that the Nikon lenses I was using weren't quite up to. I mean, this is going to get very technical sounding, but they couldn't resolve as much detail for the high resolution sensors as some of the Sony lenses that I'm using can now. So, you know, part of it is Sony's are mirrorless cameras. They're smaller. They're a little bit lighter. The other part of it is that they're just, they're newer technology for the most part. Sony pretty much makes sensors for almost everybody else except Canon. Their lenses are much newer. So they do a better job resolving the high resolution stuff. So it keeps things sharper and much more detailed.
So why... You said they're a newer company in the camera bit, like camera game, like the so why is it their technology is better than the like grandfathered older camera businesses?
Part of it is because they're a little bit newer to it. I mean, Sony bought out Minolta back when Minolta was struggling, so they had a place to start with. Because they're newer, they didn't have that history, so everything could kind of start from scratch. Whereas Canon and Nikon, you know, and this isn't a knock against them, it's just the way it is, because they have such history, they have a much more established user base, which means that they have to make sure they don't alienate that user base by, you know, totally dumping, and they're kind of starting to do it now with their moves to mirrorless technology themselves, but they don't want to alienate their existing users by just cutting things off and going to a new system. Whereas Sony, they came out with their mirrorless, and anybody they get is fairly new to the system, so they could develop, you know, new stuff without worrying about, well, this has to work with our, you know, 10-year-old camera.
Before we go, we're about to end this live stream. Does anyone have any questions? And we have a few people watching. If you have any more questions, Rick, I believe, would be willing to answer them. I'll give you everyone like a few seconds or a few minutes. Not minutes. I'm going to give everyone like 30 seconds. We're just going to talk a little bit. So anyways, Rick, it's been wonderful. If there's any more questions that do arise, I'll make a point to forward them to you. And if there is nothing else you want to add, Rick, I want everyone to know that you can find Rick on his social media at Rick Burke. com and find out like all his other social medias. They're all Rick Burke, aren't they? Or Rick Burke Photography.
Rick Burke and Rick Burke Photo on
Rick Burke photo, yeah.
On Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, follow him on that, you know. And also, if you like what we're doing, like what's happening on these YouTube, on this my YouTube channel, please hit the subscribe button and follow me there. And I try my best. I try my best to line up all these artist interviews. I have artist interviews lined up till all the way till almost the end of the year. So if you like hearing this stuff and learning from new artists, hit the subscribe button and follow me. Anyways, thank you very much, Rick. I really do appreciate you. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.